again, and welcome back to the Slow Flowers Podcast with Deborah Prinzing, episode 204. This is the weekly podcast about American flowers and the people who grow and design with them. It's all about making a conscious choice, and I invite you to join the conversation and the creative community as we discuss the vital topics of saving our domestic flower farms and supporting a floral industry that relies on a safe, seasonal, and local supply of flowers and foliage. This podcast is brought to you by slowflowers.com, the free nationwide online directory to florists, shops, and studios who design with American-grown flowers, and to the farms that grow those blooms. It's the conscious choice for buying and sending flowers. And a special thanks to our lead sponsor for 2015, the California Cut Flower Commission, committed to making a difference as an advocate for American-grown flowers. Learn more at ccfc.org. I am thrilled today to welcome author, photographer, lecturer, and radio host Ken Drews to the Slow Flowers Podcast. Ken has contributed to nearly every garden and home design magazine in America. He is probably best known for his books, which the New York Times called Bibles for Serious Gardeners. The American Horticultural Society chose his 2003 book, The Passion for Gardening, as best book of the year, and the Wall Street Journal recommended it as one of the 5 garden books to own. Ken has authored 20 gardening books, including recent titles Plantthropology, The Myths, Mysteries, and Miracles of My Garden Favorites, and Natural Companions, The Garden Lover's Guide to Plant Companions, which features both Ken's photography and that of digital botanical artist Ellen Hoverkamp. In 2004, the Garden Club of America awarded Ken the Sarah Chapman Francis Medal for Lifetime Literary Achievement. In 2013, Garden Writers Association awarded Ken the Gold Medal for Photography and the Silver Medal for Writing. In 2013, the Smithsonian Institute announced the acquisition of the Ken Drews Collection of Garden Photography, comprising 100,000 images of American gardens and plants. I've interviewed Ken for articles that have appeared in the San Diego Union-Tribune and in the Los Angeles Times. So now it is with great pleasure that I welcome him to the Slow Flowers Podcast. Ken is a garden podcast pioneer, having been on the air for at least a decade with his national podcast and public radio show, Ken Drews Real Dirt, which listeners can hear through their computers and iPods at kendrewsrealdirt.com. And I'll provide that link at deborahprinzing.com. We're here today to discuss Ken's timely new book, The New Shade Garden, Creating a Lush Oasis in the Age of Climate Change, published this past May by Stuart Taborian Chang. In it, Ken reveals the low-stress environmental benefits of gardening in the shade, including cooler temperatures and fewer water demands, and how the shade environment is extremely beneficial for our plants, our planet, and us. To him, the thriving garden of the future will exist in the shade, in the understory, in the woodland. Welcome back to the Slow Flowers Podcast with Deborah Prinzing, and I am thrilled today to welcome author, photographer, lecturer, and radio host Ken Drews as my guest. Good morning, Ken.
Oh, Deborah, I'm so happy to be back with you.
I know. The last two times you've interviewed me, so now I love turning the tables on you. And people don't know that you're in, you're in New Jersey right now, right?
In the northwest corner of New Jersey.
Okay, and I'm kind of on the west corner, northwest corner of the U.S. in Seattle, so we're doing this virtually. Ken, you have come on my radar over the years. I think I first laid eyes on you when you were lecturing in Seattle as a big-time, you know, guest lecturer for the Northwest Horticultural Society, and you had just gotten the very first copy of Making More Plants from your publisher or something. Like, they FedExed it to you, and you held it up and showed it to the audience, and it was just sort of a fun, like, bonus thing. You hadn't planned it. You're just being spontaneous, and people went crazy. And I swear, I think I even told you afterwards, even though you didn't know who I was, you could have auctioned that thing off for thousands of dollars. People were freaking out. So
now you tell me.
Yeah, seriously, it was probably some kind of fundraiser. When was that? When did that book come out?
That book came out, believe it or not, I think it's 2000.
Okay. Wow. Wow. Well, that was a plant, a book that made propagation and, you know, that all the making more plants practice to accessible to me. It wasn't like a dry horticulture school compendium or textbook. It was engaging and vividly beautiful photography. And
thank you so much.
Yeah, I loved that book so much. And so, of course, we've had a chance to connect over other books when I've been able to interview you for LA Times articles and that sort of thing. And I just have had a lot of fun delving into many of your recent books. And I'm just going to mention a couple. Recent titles that you've done include Planthropology, The Myths, Mysteries, and Miracles of Your Garden Favorites. And then Natural Companions was your most recent book prior to the new one that we're talking about today, right?
You are correct.
Natural Companions, The Garden Lover's Guide to Plant Companions, which featured both your photography and that of Ellen Hoverkamp. And I've gotten to know her through you and love her work and love how you integrated it with your sort of guide to tell people how to be bold and confident in combining plants in the garden.
And that's a very popular book with flower arranging, people who cut flowers, and because it, as you know, it has all these wonderful arrangements of plants that bloom at the same time.
Exactly. So we're going to talk about gardening, but we're going to have a little eye on the floral designers. And this is really the reason we're getting on the phone together today is to discuss your timely new book, The New Shade Garden, Creating a Lush Oasis in the Age of Climate Change, published this past May by Stuart Taborian Chang. And this is your 19th book. Is that correct?
I think it's the 20th, believe it or
20th.
Not.
20th. Oh my goodness. Congratulations.
Thank
that
you.
Is mind-blowing. But when I first saw the title, I just struck by how you have this way of putting your finger on the pulse of what people want to know about at a given time. And just the fear about losing our resources, especially water in the garden, not for everyone in the country, because I know some people are like drowning, but I'm here on the West Coast. That was incredibly provocative to see that title. And how did that come about? How did this whole book come about?
Well, I wrote a book on shade gardening in 1992, which was just about my most popular book, The Natural Shade Garden.
Right.
And over the years, since people say, oh, I love this book, it's my Bible, and they go on and on, which is very nice. And I thought, oh, I'm going to revisit that topic because it was so popular. And I didn't. It's not the same book reissued. I put that book away. I didn't even look at it. And I did a new book on shade gardening. And I thought, because of climate change, and we've had some really hot summers, record-breaking hot summers, and I'm thinking, go to the shade. Who doesn't want to be 10 to 20 degrees cooler? And I've all my life gardened in the shade, maybe because I don't like the heat, but also because, you know, you find yourself in a situation. And
you inherit shade sometimes when you
definitely
planted a garden.
I had a garden in Brooklyn, New York, which was a town garden and shaded by buildings and trees. And then I have a garden where I am now full time in New Jersey, and it's in a valley. So the most sun I get is about 8 hours in the summer in the sunniest spots, and some places much, much less. But I like it being cool. Of course, if I want to grow cut flowers or vegetables, I'm out of luck.
but you know, it's interesting because I went through every page of the New Shade Garden and took notes, and there's so many beautiful plants that especially the more progressive sort of artistic floral designers yearn for that are shade plants. And you even have a few vegetables in this book. Mm-hmm. So you're not starving people.
No, and I don't mind. there's plenty of things to see, and I love to crawl around in the spring and see some of those wonderful woodland jewels up close.
Oh, yeah.
Some of them don't make the best cut flowers. I was thinking about trillium, which we all love so much. You cut a trillium, and you cut it, you've killed it.
Yeah, you know, it's so true, and sometimes you just have to learn that by experimentation, right? It's not like there's necessarily you can't look at a plant and necessarily know, will it be happy in a vase, right?
Well, in the case of the trillium, it's only got three leaves and a flower on top. So if you cut it with a stem, you may not have killed it, but you've certainly set it back for a couple of years. But we don't have to worry about cutting trillium. We're not going to do that. There's plenty of other things that we can cut right through the season, as you know.
Well, you had me when I opened the book and saw this luscious, you know, complete edge-to-edge photograph of hellebores in the end paper. I'm like, okay, this is you're talking my language, because hellebores are very popular in, at least here in the Pacific Northwest. We have cut flower farmers who are growing masses of hellebores to sell to florists. So there's a trick to that, to keep those doing well in the vase. But the home gardener can obviously grow hellebores in the shade.
Yeah, and you have them from winter for a month or longer in the garden. And then you can cut them. And it's interesting that you said there's a trick. So what's the trick?
Well, what I'm quoting Diane Sukavati, who's the a flower farmer, a friend of mine who owns Jella Mold Farm in Mount Vernon, Washington. And she harvests her hellebores when the seed pods have begun to form. Uh-huh. And that is that beautiful, like, filaments in the, you know, in the frilly contrast in the center may have fallen off, but then you're still getting that longer lasting flower in the vase. So I don't know. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of the fruits are forming.
Right.
And in the garden, we find that very ornamental, and it lasts at least a month, those wonderful drying fruits. But I was thinking about the flowers too when they're open, because I've cut them and they don't last that long. And I'm sure in all your books you talk about conditioning, and that's one really important thing. If you're going to cut hellebores when they're just opening, you got to soak them up to their necks.
Yes, that's a really good point. You know, it's funny because there was this whole phase of people doing these tapestry moss tables with, you know, trays with moss and hellebores, just the flowers, and photographing them, and then the next day you had to toss them out. So, I mean, we are in love with that plant, but it's a hard worker in the shade garden. So I guess that's one of the reasons why you featured it so much. How many plants do you have featured in this book? I mean,
I don't know.
Yeah.
There's 400 photographs, but I'm not sure.
Oh my gosh.
How many plants?
Well,
thousands.
Yeah. Well, this all stems, I think, from reading your introduction, that you have had a lifelong relationship with the shade as a, you know, from your childhood, right? I mean, this is just brings you back to the way you grew up playing in the woods, right?
Mm-hmm. And seeing those woodland flowers, we talked about them. And I think mm-hmm. the first plant I remember recognizing, my mother showed me a Jack in the Pulpit, and she explained what it meant. And as a 4-year-old, I had no idea what she was talking about, but I knew that it was very cool. And I really liked it, and I love them.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's sort of the magic of the story, that she maybe gave you a little story about that plant, so then you had a relationship with it.
Well, and as you know, I know that every plant has a story, so mm-hmm. mm-hmm. they all do. And I've been thinking mm-hmm. about cutting plants and flowers from the garden, and now we're talking in the summer.
Right.
And we talked about how the hellebores are in the winter, and there's so many spring flowering plants in the shade, but what about now?
Right.
And I thought about...
Give me some of your favorites. I'd like to hear this.
Well, one that came to mind is Hydrangea arborescens. It has all different names, but arborescens would mean the plant of the woods, but that's not what they call it. They call it the rough hydrangea. It has different names, and it grows almost like a herbaceous plant. So when you cut it, it's not like you're cutting a hydrangea, a mop head, which you cut it and you kind of disfigured your shrub. You can cut these, and because every other year I cut them to about 6 inches tall, the whole plants, and then I get larger flowers.
Wow.
But
is that the Annabelle?
Well, Annabelle is one of the double ones. There's Annabelle and Grandiflora, and the new one is Incredible. And if you cut those when they're just the flowers are ripening and just going from white to a little bit of green, mm-hmm. you can cut them and bring them in, and you don't even have to put them in water. And they'll be beautiful to arrange. They have these giant heads of sterile flowers, sometimes about 10 inches across, believe it or not.
Yeah, you need a big vase for these babies. They're gorgeous.
But then you can just keep them and arrange them somewhere dried for 2 years. And if they start to get too dusty or too old or turn brown, just cut new ones the next year.
That's really sustainable. And it's funny you mentioned that, because I've been hearing all year this buzz that people are interested in returning to that whole everlastings and drying of
you know, flowers that maybe we did back in the 70s and 80s, and that, and there's sort of a return to that. And maybe it's just because we want to be a little bit more thoughtful about how we enjoy our plants. I don't know. The hydrangea trick you just described would fall right into that.
And you can use them fresh too. So
yeah,
you don't have
exactly.
To use them. And looking out in the garden today and walking around, I saw so many hosta flowers.
Yes.
And a lot of hosta fanatics cut their flowerscapes off when they form because they grow them for the leaves. But a lot of hostas have beautiful flowers.
Well, Ken, don't you mention all the fragrant ones in the, you know, the new shade garden? You have this amazing list of hostas that you like, and some of them are fragrant, right?
Yes, most of the fragrant ones are varieties of Hosta plantaginea, which blooms later in the summer, and they're big and white. There's even double ones, and you can cut them, and they're enormously fragrant, perfumey, jasmine smelling. But most hostas have kind of purple flowers, and there's a wonderful one called Hosta clausa that I grow that has deep amethyst flowers.
Oh my gosh.
And the scapes are about 12 to 18 inches long, dark purple. And if you get that going, it's not a clump like most hostas. It actually is a ground cover. It kind of runs a little bit. And you get this wonderful swath, a drift, or almost a stream of these dark purple flowers in late summer.
So when do you cut that, Ken? Because there's buds up and down that scape, right?
Right, and it's kind of like a daylily in a way, because you can cut daylily scapes, and then often the flowers will continue to open, even though they only last one day.
Right.
The flowers on the hosta last longer than a day, but with luck and changing the water, keeping it clean, those flowers will continue to open, depending on, you know, everything, temperature and everything. You can get at least a week out of them, at least.
Wow. What I was really struck by, since we're on the topic of hostas, is just the way you describe foliage plants, and especially that variegated foliage is such a useful design device in a dark shade garden. You know, obviously that play of cream and green or white and green is going to light up the garden floor. There's so many choices of variegated foliage that I'm sure aren't just ground covers, that they can be cut and brought in. I mean,
oh, absolutely.
We mentioned hostas, but
we should stick with hostas for a second because
go. Yeah.
The hosta leaves cut very well. Depending on the time of day you cut them and the size of the leaf, they can last anywhere from, they can last a long time. They just don't look so great.
Yeah.
But at least 3 days and often a week. And you've got the variegations. There are some hostas that are multicolored. There's a hosta striptease that's dark green and yellow and white and sort of smallish to medium-sized leaf. And one I really love is Looking Glass that's it's even a lemon yellow with creamy white. Those can be fillers and arrangements or kind of a background foil to other things that you cut. They'd be beautiful with white flowers.
I see them used as collars a lot around the kind of rim of a vase or kind of nesting a hand-tied bouquet. They just have that presentation, distinction that they're highlighting whatever is next to them.
I've seen a couple of times people submerge the leaves in a large clear glass vase and kind of line the inside of the vase with the hosta leaves and then make Have you ever seen that?
Yeah, I love that technique. It's so much nicer than having some kind of imported, tea leaf that's, exotic and from a different different time of year or a different hemisphere. So, yeah, the hosta would do that really well.
And generally, generally we have hostas, and we have
right.
And
how about how about ferns? I know that, they're in the floral design trade. There's like the generic, leatherleaf fern and maybe the sword fern. But they're in the garden. You can be a lot more experimental with ferns that like the Japanese painted fern, something a little bit more showy. I don't know, softer. Yeah, okay. Showy, right.
Well, it depends on the fern, and you said experiment. That's a good word for it. The ones that have the leathery leaves like Christmas fern, which is semi-evergreen, they're definitely going to last longer. But I think you're right. Try it. And maybe not an entire frond. You could cut the frond into some pieces and strip off a little bit of the bottom foliage and try that in water. I should try ferns more.
Well, you know, we're going to switch over to flowers then. I have to tell you that I'm just looking right at your book, your section on herbaceous perennials. Almost every single plant you have photographed in this beautiful gallery is something that is very hot right now, especially here in Seattle, in the cut flower trade. People are going crazy over, you know, obviously lady's mantle, that's kind of a good standby, but the flowers of heuchera, coral bells, the flowers of dicentra, the bleeding heart, those are yearned after. And then, of course, astilbe, which you have a whole section on. That's a really exciting flower that's showing up in the cut flower trade.
And, imagine. That's incredible.
Well, and the flower farmers have to really hustle to get volume up, right? Because
and the flowers are so small on the heuchera.
I know. Well, I think there's sort of that... They add that texture, that kind of foamy,
airy.
That component. So I think those plants are highly valued, you know, in the garden, but people, if you can get your, you know, what I see is happening is the desire for these more ephemeral blooms are really prompting a lot of progressive floral designers to grow some of their own. And that's why I think your book is going to be so inspiring. So if somebody wants those flowers and wants that foliage that like the hostas, but they're not really coming from a gardening background, they're coming from a floral design background, they could really dig deep into what you've listed, and which is so comprehensive in the new Shade Garden, and get just go for it.
Well, in the book, I'm recommending that people not only enjoy the shade, but that they make more shade.
Let's talk about that. How do you make more shade? we all want that.
Yeah, sometimes it means a structure, some architecture, which might be nice, like a pergola or some other shading awning or something. Mm-hmm. But mostly it means planting more trees. And we want to plant trees because, as we know, they sequester CO2. When you watch a tree growing, you know, you think, well, there's water and you feed the tree and everything like that. But if you think about what that tree is made of, it's taking CO2 out of the air and turning it into wood. So we don't think of that, but that's really what it is. It's really
that's its job. Yeah.
It's pulling the CO2 out of the air. And we've been talking about cut flowers. Just think about those spring flowering trees like dogwoods, the smaller understory trees, the small trees like cyrsus, the red bud. And the white red bud, which is just talk about those airy, ephemeral, beautiful. Mm. They just float above an arrangement. And of course, a lot of them can be forced. But I think just a branch of dogwood, a variegated dogwood with some white bracts, that would be beautiful in arrangement.
And Ken, do these understory trees, the smaller ones, are they adaptable to container life? Would that work for somebody who had just a patio?
I don't think that would be great. It would be okay for a couple of years if you could then find a home for it in your climate survive. But I think long term, maybe not.
Mm-hmm. They are happier putting their roots down into the ground.
Yeah, but there's things like Japanese maples that the smaller ones, they would be wonderful in containers for years. And some of the smaller hemlocks would be great in containers, like the dwarf weeping ones. There are lots of things that can grow in containers. And as I write about in the book, if you have a tree with shallow roots, and rather than going in there and digging up those roots and damaging them to plant, put containers there.
And
you can elevate the containers on a few bricks so they're not really sitting on the roots, and find a spot for those bricks. So there's a little bit of air circulation. But you can have an entire container garden either with temporary things or permanent things right under shallow rooted trees.
I love that idea. And back to the topic, which we kind of got off topic about making more shade. I was particularly impressed with your suggestions for growing against walls and fences. And there's one photo that really struck me that you had portrayed a light-colored stucco exterior of a house or something that had something espaliered against it, and that you said that the lighter color then reflects, provides reflective light. Right. Is that sort of a trick that you do in garden design, or is it just sort of naturally, if you have a spot, take advantage of it?
Well, both, I guess. But when I was in the garden in Brooklyn, I put mirrors around, and I thought that was fun. You know, I found big mirrors and framed them, and they would reflect shafts of light. But I found that the pale-colored walls, because I did paint my walls a light color to reflect the light, they did a better job. And it was markedly noticeable that reflected light really helped the plants. You know, some plants would be leaning towards the little bit of sun that I might have or the
sure.
plants. But then when I painted the walls white, they stood up.
Oh, I love that. That's great. Well, one of the hottest plants right now in the cut flower industry is the return of the foxglove. And that is according to you, a very happy shade plant. So how do you grow foxgloves? Do they just naturalize through your garden, or?
Well, it depends on the foxglove.
Okay.
Some of them are, especially the one, well, I was going to say perennials, but that's not exact. I'm contradicting myself.
It's okay. We want to learn. So there's a lot of digitalis then, varieties, some that are perennials and some that are more like biennials.
Yeah,
is that
most
right?
Most of them are biennials.
Okay.
The one that you see that kind of does naturalize, the Digitalis purpurea, which is the common foxglove. It's either kind of a magenta-y pink or white. Those can naturalize if they're really happy in the right spot, and that's not
okay.
a garden.
mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
sometimes I get them, they are biennials, and I'll either start them from seed and I'll get 1 year, but they don't really return for me. But there's a perennial, which is Digitalis grandiflora with cream-colored flowers, and it's about 2 feet tall, and that does very well for me.
Wow.
So I love that. And I have one called Digitalis lanata, which has kind of brown flowers. And I've had a few over the years, and they tend to be a little promiscuous and hybridized, and I get surprises. And I never know where they're going to come up. They pop up, and it's not like there's a million of them. There's usually two or three. I always want.
But they add a little whimsy, a little vertical spike to the shade guard.
And in shade, in a lot of shade, they kind of elongate. They're mm-hmm. not as chubby as they are in the sun or the sunny
they're
garden.
They're stretching up for more light. Well, that's okay, right?
Yeah.
The other thing I thought was really awesome in your book and is that you tell people like me who and anybody in the northern part of the U.S. What to do with your house plants in the summer. And these are plants that, you know, when I lived in Southern California, I would see all this stuff in the garden. I'm like, that's a house plant. Right. But now that I'm back in Seattle, I realize I can take certain tender plants outdoors in the summer and give them a little vacation, right? And create like begonias, create a little landscape in my garden with obviously shade-loving houseplants.
Yeah, I was thinking about begonias today as cut flowers because you could cut the begonia section, put it in a vase, enjoy it as a cut flower, and in 2 weeks it'll have roots. And then you've got a new plant.
I absolutely love that. It's so interesting you say that because I've been experimenting with this idea that any plant that you would typically root from a cut, you do like just a water cutting, like, well, obviously begonias are a really good example, but even like pelargonium or
coleus.
Yeah. Then they obviously are happy in water, and so they're probably going to be a great cut element as well. And since you're going to, if you would propagate them that way, then they probably look great in water. And a lot of herbs are like that too, ironically.
Yeah. Well, I always take the house plants out for vacation, as you said. And then they get the rain on them, and it cleans their leaves, and they look so great. And indoors, you know, by March, the house plants are looking pretty bad.
They're like, Daddy, take us out.
I know. They look really good until March. And then I just wait for those first guaranteed frost-free days, which for me, we had a killing frost once on Memorial Day here.
Wow.
I have a very short season, and you don't have such a short season. But I take them outdoors and arrange them, you know, sometimes on staging, like little steps on some
benches that I have, and they become part of the garden. Especially, they're especially nice for the sheltered spot where you want to sit, because they usually want shade too.
You have the most beautiful photo where you have repurposed an outdoor fireplace as the staging vignette for your outdoor, you know, bringing your houseplants outdoors. And I can picture you sitting there and just reading the paper or having a cup of tea and or cocktail. And you must feel like, well, I go on vacation. I mean, you're living in paradise.
I do feel like that.
there are a lot of photos of your personal garden in New Jersey in this book, right? I mean, this is really, you're telling the story of your own garden as well.
Yeah, but there's photographs of the Bellevue Botanical Garden, for example, so I got around.
Yeah, the Miller Garden. I saw the Miller Garden in this in my neck of the woods in this book, so it's fun. Well, Ken, you've always traveled, and in your photography has taken you around the globe, basically, right? I mean, you photograph all your own books. Mm-hmm. I was really impressed in your bio to read that the Smithsonian announced the acquisition of the Ken Drews collection of garden photography. How did that come about? That's so awesome.
Well, I sold my house in Brooklyn, and I moved full-time to New Jersey, and I had well over 100,000 transparencies film. And now, of course, we shoot digital. Everybody does. And it was hard to move them in all those file cabinets, and they were organized and labeled. And I contacted the Smithsonian and asked them if they were interested. And at first they said no, and then they said yes very much when they found out what they were. Mm-hmm. And I offered them all of them.
Wow.
They only wanted American ones. So, was about 100,000.
So then did you have to go edit that whole, all those files to pull out just the American ones?
No, because that wasn't so hard, actually.
Okay. Oh, that's good.
I had most of the ones like New Zealand and Australia were in their own, and Canada even, were in their own file. So they stayed separate. And they even took the pictures of the headshots of plants. And people can actually use them.
That's what I was going to ask you. Like, how will this be? Will only researchers have access to this, or?
No, I think. I don't know about private people, but they do lend them out for publication. Mm-hmm. And you asked me about organizing them, because then they got 100,000, and I thought, what are they going to do with this over the next 7 years?
Good luck.
And they said, interns.
Exactly. That's the secret. Exactly. Oh, I love that. That's really impressive. And how gratifying to know that, you know, this is not going to just sit in some dusty closet somewhere, or you're not going to haul it from house to house.
Or be thrown away.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's really exciting.
You know, people said, you should scan them. Can you imagine scanning 100,000 pictures?
No.
I can't.
No. So that would need an army of interns.
It's thrilling that they're there, and very gratifying, as you said.
Oh, that's really neat. Well, now, I was just asking you before we got on the recording how long you've had your podcast. So the podcast and public radio show is called Ken Drews Real Dirt. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I listened to it. In fact, I was excited to see that you just had Quill Teal on recently. She's somebody I've met through the floral industry. Is it Meadowburn Farm?
Yeah.
But you interview people every week. And how long have you been doing this, Ken?
No, when you asked me before, I was starting to think about it. And we started on Sirius satellite radio when they launched. How long ago is that? That's
wow.
At least 10 years, maybe more.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. Well, you do have the best radio voice. That's amazing.
Oh, you're so sweet.
So you've been doing a weekly garden show, and now people obviously can listen to it through their computers and download on their iPods, and then it's broadcast on a public radio station in your community. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Actually, in Northwest Connecticut, so even I can't listen to it live.
Oh, how funny! But I think you're one of the first national kind of new media radio, garden radio personalities. You know, most people, every community has their own little hometown, you know, radio garden personality. But you kind of took it to the internet and and obviously through Sirius, that was like available everywhere. So I feel like you've done this huge service to the community by bringing these voices on. And it's, Yeah, it's fun. I when I first met you, when I first was a guest on your podcast, I never dreamed that I would get into this too. So I'm fascinated to know how do you run the show and how do you select guests and what kind of feedback are you getting? You have people who listen all over the globe, right?
I you're right, and those are great questions, and I wish I had gotten more feedback. And I think, what am I doing this for? I'm here alone in the ether, and I recorded in my home, and it's done via Skype, and people talk on landline telephones, mm-hmm. and somebody mm-hmm. might have something about the environment that I've caught somewhere, or a new book coming out, or something, just like you find people to be on your podcast,
sure.
too.
Sure, and like seasonal topics, that sort of thing, right?
And then, yeah, seasonal topics, and sometimes it's just me talking about something that's happened to me, especially when a guest doesn't show up. That actually never happens. I shouldn't say that.
I love it. Well, just call me and I'll do the same for you.
Oh, that sounds really good. But the thing that I was going to say is, whenever I think who's out there, I'll run into someone and they'll say, oh, I listened to your podcast this week. It's so great. Or I'll get an email. Never enough. I want to hear more from these people.
Yes.
But they're there. They're listening. I can't stop.
That's so cool.
They kill me.
So now that you've gotten the new Shade Garden, published, I hope you're taking a little bit of a break to enjoy your garden. But I'm sure you're doing a lot of lectures and, interviews, because this book really only came out a couple months ago. What's on your plate? What are you working on? Are you doing a lot of traveling, or how can people find you? Do you list your lectures on your website?
I do list my lectures on the website, and I don't do as many as I used to, just because I want to be here, especially now in the season. And I've been doing major changes to the garden. I've sort of had to, because some big things died. As we haven't talked about, but I've had issues with water here.
I've been watching you on Facebook. You've had like flooding, right?
We had flooding, and a couple of big trees gave up. So now there's new areas, and they're still not that sunny, but we do have some new areas to plant in and move things around. And I'm always moving something around and discovering new things, and the garden's matured. Yeah. I think when I started this garden, I always thought that gardens just got better with age and time, but they actually kind of peak, and then you have to prune. mm-hmm. and redo and move things. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. we don't want it ever to be done. So that's great.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, that whole, bringing that editor's eye to what you've created takes discipline, because, it's like killing your babies, but really sometimes you're helping the plant by giving it a strong edit, or moving it, or even replacing it. Yeah.
You're always doing that. Mm-hmm. And you asked me about the lectures. Just coincidentally, this month I had an event last Wednesday. Next week I'll be in Maine speaking, and then 2 weeks later I'm going to speak for Margaret Roach on her annual. She has a couple of days that she's open.
So Ken, I have a challenge for you. Mm-hmm. I would love it if you would go out today or sometime this week and make a bouquet from your shade garden and send me a photograph so we can share it on my show notes at deborahprinzing.com when this interview is aired. Would you be up for that?
No way. Of course. Deborah, for you.
Twist your arm.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, because when I listened to you describe some of the things you were excited about, I could just picture them in your hands. just that, that gathering of the surprises and gifts from that woodland shade landscape. And I'd love to see that if you have time. We would love to share that.
I'll try to do that.
All right. That sounds great. And I just want to say, Ken, this book is so deeply relevant. There are so many things that I learned. I was so appreciative of you including even simple things like, I guess some people take this for granted, but I find it useful, like the native plant glossary, just this whole description of what is native, what is indigenous, what is local, what's a wildflower. I think we throw these terms around and we don't necessarily consider what it means to our landscape or to our local environment. So I found that really helpful, and hopefully will guide people to make smart choices and sort of ethical choices about what they're growing and doing in their own corner of the U.S. or North America.
I hope so too, and it's so nice of you to mention that.
Yeah. Well, so what are you working on next?
Well, I've got these lectures this month. And
your plate is pretty full, I'm sure.
So full. I don't know how I'm going to make that cut arrangement for you. Because I haven't put my lecture together yet.
Okay. Well, we'll do that first.
And I'm and right after we speak, I'm going to go right back out to the garden and I'll probably do a little weeding.
Oh, great. But nobody's pressuring you to do your 21st book yet.
I'm speechless. No one is. But the way these things happen, something occurs to me, and then it sort of I think about it for a while, and I do know a lot about shade gardening. But in many cases, I guess I'm more of a journalist because when I, for example, the propagation book, which is one of my favorites, I wanted to learn all that stuff. So it wasn't like I was the big expert. I talk to people. It's what you do too. And I try different things and try everything three different ways. And the one that works best, I write about and make it as beautiful and interesting as possible. So it's a discovery.
It's a gift to have that curiosity. And I agree completely. I learn by writing about something and many people don't have that curiosity. And so I applaud you for not doing these superficial ideas, but going really deep and doing that research and sort of testing yourself and then writing about it. So that's what I mean about making your topic so accessible to people because they're personal and you've spent a lot of time with the topic before you send that book off to the printer. So I love that about you and your work. And I hope that I get to see you in person one of these days, but I guess this is the next best thing. So thank you. Thank you for sharing sort of love affair with shade gardening. I know that all these farmer florists, these sort of that term that's out there, the floral designers who want to grow their own flowers, will find sort of a new resource for these aren't traditional field crops. These are plants that are jewels that you can grow in small or large quantities, depending on how large your garden is, to use. Maybe for a special floral design project. So, of course, that's my interest. You probably aren't advocating that people cut up their shade garden, but if they need to, this is the book for them too.
Well, and as you said, if you have the space, you can do it.
Great. Ken, thank you so much for being on the podcast. And we'll share some photos from the book and links to all of Ken's social places, as well as to Real Dirt, his wonderful podcast, which you need to also start subscribing to, listeners. And you'll get to know this amazing gentleman who I really admire. And I'm just so glad to share your voice today on the show. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you so much.
Joining me today to learn more about shade gardening. I come to floral design inspired by the residential garden and a love of plants. Learning from a master like Ken Drews is a huge treat, and I hope you found what he shared as inspiring as I did. Please visit DeborahPrinzing.com for photos and links to Ken's work and his social places, including the Real Dirt podcast. I'll be sure to include the links to the two episodes where Ken interviewed me. On his website, Ken writes, "Spending time in nature, especially nurturing plants, strengthens our connection with the natural rhythms of life. In the garden, we often experience a kind of meditation therapy. Weeding actually becomes a time to sort through the other parts of our busy lives." I couldn't agree more, and like Ken, I see the garden as a metaphor for life. If you are in the Northeast next month, you have a chance to hear Ken Drews' lecture on shade, and to take his hands-on garden photography workshop, as well as shop a rare plant sale and tour the Copaic Falls, New York garden of fellow garden writer, editor, and podcaster Margaret Roach as part of the Garden Conservancy Open Days on August 15th. I'll share details and links on DeborahPrinzing.com so you can reserve tickets for the Ken Drews events and find the full day's schedule. Listeners like you have downloaded this podcast nearly 58,000 times. Thank you to each and every one of you for downloading, listening, commenting, and sharing. It means so much. Until next week, you're invited to join me in putting more American-grown flowers on the table, one vase at a time.
And if you like what you hear, please consider logging onto iTunes and posting a listener review. The content and opinions expressed here are either mine alone or those of my guests alone, independent of any podcast sponsor or other person, company, or organization. The Slow Flowers podcast is engineered and edited by Andrew Wheatley and Hannah Holtgertz. Learn more about their work at shellandtree.com.